Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. We've been studying the Four Noble Truths in town, which is, we restudy this teaching again and again and again. And it's the kind of primary teaching of Theravada Buddhism, within which all other teachings fall. And its basic structure, most of you know. There is suffering, there is the origin of suffering, there's the cessation of suffering, and there's the path which leads to the cessation of suffering. And the word suffering is, the Pali word is dukkha, and dukkha is very, very broad, as you know, so it can mean minor things or major things. So some people find the word suffering too big. Some teachers use stress. But in any form of discontent that we experience as human beings, we are going to try to address. We're going to try to be happy. That's our motivation in whatever way we do that. And so when we're stressed or unhappy or suffering or whatever, we're going to distract, blame, investigate, meditate, find a way out, get more meshed in it. There's many ways that human beings deal with this. And It's a very good teaching that way, because it's very practical and it's very, very humble in many ways. It's not like looking at something that you don't know yet and that you have to find, but it's actually looking at what you do have, what we all have. And the issue in these Four Noble Truths is around wanting. In the Pali we call it tanha, but if you contemplate wanting, it's such a broad idea in the English language, and it seems to me if we don't understand wanting and we're simply some reactive through wanting, then we don't really understand ourselves, and if we don't understand ourselves, we're not really free. So you could think we have simple things like functional wanting, like my head itches and I scratch. Okay? That's normal garden variety wanting. We all have that. I want a sweater, I go upstairs and get it. I want a glass of water and I get it, and so on. So one of the ways to look at this is when does wanting become problematic? When does it become suffering? So let's say I'm a smoker, and I've been smoking for a few years. I want to smoke, but I want to give up smoking. I think it's a bit more complicated, isn't it? I'm a person who gets angry all the time. I want to lash out, but I also want to be free from anger. I enjoy distracting into YouTube. Right, and yet I realize I spend 16 hours a day on YouTube or whatever. So I want to absorb into the screen, and yet I want to spend my time in another way. So you can see in the whole issue of wanting, there is skillful wanting and unskillful wanting. There's wanting that leads to very, very good results, and wanting which leads to bad results. And there's wanting which is very neutral. No big deal. And observing all of that in ourselves is really the essence of the Four Noble Truths, isn't it? And watching how we respond to the impulses of wanting. So some people, like in this study that we've been doing, some people got very not very confused, but somewhat confused about the idea of attachment to wanting. How does that work? And the example I gave, if I'm in Ottawa and I live in Kanata, and I have an appointment in Orleans, and I get on the motorway, and the appointment is, you know, it's just part of my life. I want to get to Orleans. So there's no suffering in that. It's just a necessity of my life, part of my routine. And then I hit the motorway, and I'm at the Carling exit, and there's this massive traffic jam. So all of a sudden, my wanting is confronted by something, a very unpleasant image, construction and traffic. And so now it changes from being just a functional wanting to having the potential to be frustrating. Why? Because this experience now has become somewhat unpleasant. And you can see when we talk about attachment to wanting, right there, that first frustration to that which I want to do is challenging me to be aware and then to investigate, well, what am I going to do with this? So which doesn't mean that I stop driving or stop functioning. I mean, I think, well, I'll get off, I'll take the Carling exit, and I'll try to do Carling, and so on. So we keep to our strategy, we keep to our goals, because we all have goals, we need to do things. But all the time, our hearts are somehow responding to these things, reacting, responding. And the contemplative, meditative aspect of this is to know oneself, and then to see, well, what choices did I make with that traffic jam? Do I make the choice to say swear, or do I make the choice to look at my breath? Do I make the choice to eat a chocolate bar, or whatever it might be? And these kinds of things are happening all the time. And that's a very simple example, but we can have much more complicated examples, maybe for whatever reason. When I communicate with a group of people, I always want them to like me. I'm not quite sure where that might come from. I have some ideas, you know, maybe talk to a psychologist and so on. But that kind of wanting then is more insidious. It's more ingrained in my consciousness, more automatic in the way I relate the choices I make. So you can see there, I need to have even more mindfulness, don't I? Because the interactions with human beings are so quick, and the person frowns slightly, and I do all kinds of things to make sure they like me. But if I'm not aware of that, then of course there's no peace. Every time I come into a situation, that underlying wanting to be liked, determines the way I function. And then if I'm not aware of that, and I do that 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, then it becomes almost like, well, it becomes my personality. It's hard to see it objectively. So there are many layers. There are many, many layers to wanting. And these layers are very personal. And as long as we feel any inner discontent, we have to address it if we're going to be free. So there's the kind of the necessity for personal responsibility. Now, this meditation we did, I suggest that we begin with non-desire. Right? And as soon as we make effort, as soon as we undertake something, to sit and meditate or to make some lovely food, we have a goal in mind. I want to make sure that the potatoes are well cooked, or I want to... So in meditation, it's very important to see that actually, we're trying to attain anything. We're just trying to remember the state of non-desire. Because in the state of non-desire, you find peace. And it's not something you can get with desire. Well, you can. You can kind of see it as a kind of wanting, can't you? I want to be peaceful. I want to be find a space that which is not confused, and so on. And so I like the ideas of balance as opposed to becoming. Like just to remember this, just to remember, like to listen, say. and bring your consciousness to a state of non-desire. It's not something you get by getting rid of thought, by getting rid of emotion, by attaining something else. It's more like something you remember, like riding a bicycle. Or like cooking or whatever. You just remember, yeah, that's the way you do that. It becomes more and more a part of you. So the way the Pali talks about wanting, the unskillful wanting or craving, it talks about, as you know, three areas. One is just the wanting of the sensually attractive beauty, comfort, sweet fragrances, and anything that is sensually attractive, as opposed to which is sensually unattractive, discomfort, raucous noises, unpleasant thoughts, unpleasant emotions. These are all part of our sensual makeup, and the capacity to now. Obviously, we tend to make choices to maximize pleasure and to minimize pain. So, without making any judgments against that, the teaching says, well, is that not a limited strategy? And we know it is, because even though I might have options to maximize my pleasure, I realize that so often it's out of my control. The body has pain and illness, and people don't cooperate with my plans for happiness and all the rest of it. So one sees limitations of sense happiness. Limitations, not the negation of that, because we'll always, you know, we're in a sense body and we'll always be making choices to feel comfortable and so on. But when you realize the limitations of that, and say in meditation you see that a lot, when you just like physical discomfort, it's not pleasant, right? But if it's not all that hurtful and harmful, you learn how to abide in non-desire with the unpleasant. And this is a more profound strategy than just seeking the pleasant. All of us who started meditation, most of us probably 5 minutes was murder when you first start. You're restless, was for me. And then I would react, and then I'd try to get into a better posture, and then I'd try to right my posture, and it just was an endless restlessness. And the teacher said, no, you just have to be patient with the unpleasant. So I want to abide in a more peaceful state of mind. What do I have to do? I have to abide with the unpleasant with non-desire. In other words, knowing the unpleasant is just unpleasant, and that's harder to do. I want to give up smoking. So the desire for smoking comes up, and that desire, if I follow it, it is pleasant to some extent, but not in the grand scale of things. So I choose to abide in silent witnessing with this desire, but not the desire to get rid of, but simply to know this unpleasantness come up. And then the unpleasantness, I don't pursue it into another activity, I just know it, this is unpleasant. And then that unpleasantness becomes bearable. And as it becomes more bearable, I witness to it, and what happens is the mind begins to abide as non-desire, rather than always reacting with desire. Yeah, that's much, much more difficult, very difficult, giving up smoking, it's very, very difficult. And so in the teaching we said, would you not give up a lesser happiness for the sake of a greater happiness? Would not any intelligent and sane person do that? Well, yes, but it's hard. I'm a person that likes to, these are extreme examples. We have much more subtle minds, but I want to lash out with anger. I just tend to be angry and lash out at people. Well, that's pleasant. There's a kind of pleasant to dump on people. There's a certain pleasantness to that. But of course, the results, the consequences are not good. So then that comes up, the judgment of the person and the desire to lash out. But now, one's abiding as witness to that unpleasantness and not seeking an outlet. And so that unpleasantness of not liking the person, not liking the way they are, being frustrated by them, that unpleasantness arises, and it's held in non-desire, in awareness of just the way it is. And that's hard. That's hard to do, because everything in me is always maybe lashed out and hurt people. And then as one abides with that, then that tendency towards reacting in that particular way is weakened. And as it's weakened, you find that, non-desire, that's a nice place. But it takes some work. And this is the difficulty, in the Buddhist path, is quite often by giving up, the giving up of one kind of desire for a deeper realization actually might intensify the unpleasantness of your life. Say a person who gives up an addiction, an extreme example, a person who gives up an addiction, like cigarettes or alcohol or whatever it might be that people give up, not having that is an intensification of the unpleasant. Right? And yet, by bearing witness to that, the larger goal is realized. Hard work. It's hard work. And it might be like loneliness or self-disparagement. Like, we have very, very perverse habits of craving, where we attach to ideas of self which are very, very strange. Like self-disparagement. What a strange thing to do. To hate yourself. Right? And yet we'll do that. It's very odd. It kind of makes no real sense. And yet we'll beat ourselves up for some minor infraction of the universal rules of life, whatever we think. And why do we do that? Why? What's the logic there? Well, sometimes the logic is just lost in time. For some reason, the mind has picked up this habit, and it just becomes like, it's just kind of comfortable gravity, like an old chair you sink into that ruins your posture, an old soft chair. And so we also have habits of which aren't so visible. The mind just kind of falls into them. So if we take something like self-disparagement, then to not go there means what? Well, we need to also develop the capacity to focus more on the present moment, because much of these insidious habits, which don't have, they don't have that much emotional power, but they just occupy our thoughts a lot. There needs to be the capacity to focus more, to just really do what you're doing. Chop the vegetables, drink the water, walk along the path. Just this capacity to witness the way things are. So in this meditation, when we are practicing non-desire, we're also practicing some kind of focus, which helps us stay present. Focus on the end of the out-breath. You really use something to make the present moment more obvious. Because much of our suffering that we have as human beings is really just going to spaces which are unskillful, out of habit, and like we can do skillful things, like say, I'm not going there. Now that's a wanting. I don't want to go down the path of self-disparagement, but it can just be done from pure skill. I'm not going there. We can do that. I'm not going there. That's not repression, it's just not going there. And where do you go? Well, you go to the present moment. The breath is this way. So in learning to meditate, I think we're always learning to meditate, just that capacity, like when if you're meditating, your mind keeps getting kidnapped, right? Keep planning or organizing or regretting or whatever, and the mind goes on. Just to develop like determination to say, no, the breath, or no, just this moment. But not with a desire to get rid of. That's hard to do, because quite often I want to get rid of thought, which makes me more tense. But just with this kind of skillful wanting, no, I'm just going to stay with it, this moment. It's just the way it is. Nope, I'm not going there. And these kinds of skills can be misused. I can try to use meditation to repress thought, but I won't be happy, I won't be peaceful. But also I can just sort of waffle around in some vague sense of being present, but not really have much clarity or focus. The sensual, say, desires we call kama tanha, but there's also the desires of what we might call the desires of ego, the wantings of ego, for lack of a better term, we call bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. And that, if you look at the mind, how much of a sense of self arises from a future possibility, a future scenario, either a worry or a hope or expectation or a dream. So this whole world of me going somewhere to do something else, and that comes from the past of me having been somewhere, and so much of the attachment, much of our attention is taken up with thought which is not fruitful, doesn't really lead to the peace of the heart, and that's the kind of wanting to be a certain type of a person, or wanting security, or wanting to be loved, or just wanting to do something else than wash the dishes. The mind just trips off somewhere. Bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. And that's very powerful. Just this drive of self perpetuation, ego perpetuation. Now you notice in non-desire, if you really just do that, there's no self in that. There's still presence, but there isn't a sense of me doing something to become something. It's just that. It's silent. Isn't it? It's just silent. There's no one there. Well, there is. There's presence. But there isn't a program of me going somewhere in the future. It's different. There's just clarity. There's heat or whatever you call it. There's noise, sound, bodily feeling. But it's empty of this bhava and vibhava tanha. It's empty of a self trying to get something or get rid of something. And these are the practices of emptiness that you hear about in Buddhism. They're not vacuous in the sense that there's still clarity and there's still brightness. There isn't a sense of me in psychological time trying to do something, get something. And this comes very, very obvious, like say in if you're planning something or whatever, or you're afraid of something, your mind projects into the future with thought. But it can be an more insidious one in meditation, where you sit down with the idea that you've read about some enlightenment experience or some problem you think you have to get rid of. And so you sit down already with bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. You always sit down with this program. I have to meditate hard in order to get over that hurdle and over that hill so that in yonder space I'll be happy and free. But that's still fraught with ego, with self-view, and with craving, and it doesn't really awaken to non-desire. Huh? Yes, awakening to non-desire is actually very, very ordinary, but it's extraordinarily hard to sustain, it seems to be, for most people. So when I suggested we start the sitting with non-desire, how long can I stay balanced like that before the mind slips into whatever it likes to slip into? So the issues around wanting are very important, and how can you find non-desire with wanting? How can you find non-desire with wanting? Well, you can do skillful wanting, like I want to be. What is it that preoccupies my mind? I find what preoccupies my mind is I have a friend who is always planning, he says. He wakes up in the morning and he starts lists. And he does lists, and he does lists, and he does lists. And he's always planning, and always planning. And although it's been, to some extent, rewarding, it's become rather boring for him and unpleasant. And he sees that that's just a way of keeping his mind busy, getting away from fear or whatever. So he wants to be free from that. He sees its limitation. So that's a good kind of wanting, isn't it? But how do you then take that intuitive wanting, or wanting, seeing the need for peace, or seeing the beauty of a mind which isn't just obsessed all the time? How do I take that wholesome wanting, and then take it to a state where I'm free from wanting? to kind of, does that make sense? Is that possible? Well, it is, because I realize that the state of not wanting is always here and now. So the state of not wanting, of non-desires, is always here and now. But anything I want in the future can only be in the future. So I want a mind sometime in the future that won't plan. So every time planning comes up, I try to get rid of planning. But that's all wanting. But to cut through that, I have to cut through the concept. I have to cut through the perceptions of what we call psychological time. I am someone who's inadequate, right? And I want to get to yonder space where I'm going to be fulfilled. And anything that gets in the way there, I'm going to work at it and get rid of it. But that's all self, bhava, becoming, getting rid of. But in any moment, when I say life is just this way now, and I hang out in non-desire, that's it. I've done it. I'm there. And that's not something you get through a whole program of getting rid of. It's something you learn to remember again and again and again and again. So I say one thing, rebalance, reformatting, whatever language you like to use, again and again and again. It's not becoming, it's being. It's being, right? So it's very hard to, so say, this person I'm talking with about planning, what underlies that is a certain amount of anxiety. And of course that anxiety is alleviated to a little bit through the planning. It feels good. It's like, I want to smoke a cigarette, feels good. But what's the deeper cure for that? The deeper cure is sitting through unfulfilled desire. So the anxiety comes up for the person, and to sit with that, with unfulfilled desire, just with the unpleasantness of that, and also just kind of giving up the pleasantness of the planning, because they go together, and just being with that takes you to non-desire. And that's in the moment, in the moment, in the moment. It's not future. We remember the pleasant, so we want to repeat it, and then we try to get rid of the unpleasant by going to the pleasant. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with enjoying cherry pie and pistachio ice cream, was it? But it's not that spiritual experience. It's a sensual experience, which is fine. Nothing wrong with that. But to realize the limitation of that, to realize the limitation of all that kind of externalization of our life, and to realize that that which is profoundly peaceful, that which is really liberating, isn't an object. The emotions are objects. Cherry pie is an object. Having people like me is an object. Physical comfort is an object. These are all objects to awareness. But all objects are, can they really ever fulfill me? Can they ever fulfill me? And they can't, because they're always changing. They're not secure. They're not reliable. So what's really reliable is awareness of change. To know the life as it is now, which is not a matter of time. It doesn't matter how it is now or how it's changing now. What matters, it's this way. It feels this way. Now, if I can sit for 45 minutes and train in that, and I can take anything that comes, like, without hurting myself, I mean, you can move if you want, but just to be with, like, a boring meditation, or a painful knee, or whatever it is, and just abide as non-desire, knowing the way things are, knowing change, that's the doorway to the most peaceful part of consciousness. And that is the most peaceful part of consciousness. So our wanting is moderated by morality. It's moderated by just a sense of decency, a sense of self-respect. We have all those kinds of ways that we limit our craving mind, our wanting mind. But the irony of this is that where our deepest wanting is fulfilled is in non-desire. Because what are we really looking for? Are we really looking for an object, or are we looking for the end of desire? When you get that object, then for a second or a minute or 5 minutes, there's some sense of relief. But it's the relief we're looking for, not the object. But if we always just focus on the object, be it an emotion or a person or whatever, then when it changes, we have to seek another object, another object, another object. So what we're seeking are not objects, not experiences as per se, but just that very profound knowing of the way things are, the profound knowing of change. So this is something that can be known. You can know this. You can just start your meditation with non-desire. Bas. Finished. And just remember that. Remember that. So the techniques of meditation are simply, I think, to return to that. To help remember that, whether it's the breath or the practice of the heart or body sweeping, whatever we do, is just to remember that. That's it. And then if I just accentuate that is it, the mind gets really happy. Because you bring your mind to non-desire and say, well, that's it. Oh, great. I don't have to do anything. I just have to be here. Because the mind is very happy with non-desire. It's desire that makes us unhappy. So there's functional wanting, there's ego wanting, there's sense wanting. It's a big topic. There's nothing wrong with wanting. Not understanding wanting is troublesome. And then there's non-desire. It's that state of pure awareness. All right? Something to contemplate. I'll leave that for today.
Andavayam dhavagataya sadhukaram dhamase sadhukaram.